Welcome to episode 18 of Frank Reactions, the podcast where we help you unlock profits in the digital era through better customer experiences online and off. My name's Tema Frank and I'm your host. In today's episode, I'm interviewing Shem Schott, who is the e-commerce business development and digital marketing manager at Hewlett-Packard in Toronto. And he will be speaking at eTail Canada. They've got a conference coming up in Toronto, May 11th to 14th. I'm looking forward to attending part of that myself. I'm sort of having to split myself between that and a B2B conference going on at the same time in Chicago. But if you are interested in attending the eTail Canada conference, Frank Reactions listeners get a 25% discount just by using the code ETAILCA15FRANK. That's the number 15. Don't worry about remembering that now. You'll also find a link to that in the show notes that go with today's episode. And you can find those easily by going to frankreactions.com/18. In today's interview, Shem and I talked about B2B marketing strategy and how it differs from B2C. But the reason that I find this particularly interesting for the Frank Reactions podcast is he believes that in the B2B world, especially when you're selling big, expensive, complex products, customer experience is even more important than in the B2C world. I will chat with you briefly at the end of today's interview.
Well, I've been with HP for 15 years. My background's actually in computer science and physics, so I'm more on the technical side, you could say. Before I started with HP, I had a startup. I was actually partner in an email marketing company.
Oh, cool.
We were fairly successful. We had a number of large bank customers around the world, a couple of multinationals and things, those types of.
When was that?
That was in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay.
I started working with HP. I took a role as a team lead in web development. I started doing a little bit more project management. And then I started working as a lead for Canada B2B. E-commerce. And at that point in time, it was really in its infancy. We only had a couple of customers and we grew that as customers came on board. We grew that to, you know, at the end, we were managing, you know, 70 plus customers in Canada. I also took on Latin America as well. Our business at the end, you know, when I took this most recent role, we were doing, you know, tens of millions of dollars in revenue, Latin America and Canada.
So what did you do that made that go from two customers to 70?
Well, in Canada, 2 to 70. In Latin America, it was more like 150.
Okay.
So it was a large number. And you have to imagine these are B2B customers, right? So a lot of these customers are global multinationals. So they create agreements with HP globally, and then locally we execute. So really, okay. It was about first and foremost enabling execution. How well can you meet the customer requirements in terms of what's on the site, how fast is it refreshed, what's the accuracy, you know, in those types of environments you're mm-hmm. frequently dealing with complex catalogs, complex configurations, a lot of complex pricing, and first and foremost, what's most important is accuracy. Most recently, I was given the challenge of really growing the e-commerce business here in Canada.
The e-commerce, then, is that strictly B2C or is B2B or both?
When I say e-commerce, I mean B2C.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I meet with vendors, I roll out new programs, I operationalize those programs, I look at efficiencies and try to get those things going.
So let's talk a little bit. First, I'm curious about what sorts of differences you've seen in the B2B versus B2C, both in terms of what your message is, but also in terms of how you communicate that message and how you make the whole thing work smoothly.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the main difference, I think, and even B2B, I mean, you have to differentiate B2B. A lot of people speak about consumer sales and they speak about corporate, and then in the middle, they throw SMB, right? And typically SMB gets stuck with business. And I would argue, and I always say this, that really SMB is really divided into two types. It's SMB that acts like a consumer, and there's SMB that acts mm-hmm. like a corporate account. And they're very, very, very much different. If you're thinking of B2C, that of an SMB customer that acts like a consumer, you really treat them as such. You treat them as a one-time customer who comes, shops, leaves, potentially is going to get some of your marketing messaging, comes back, maybe at some later point, buys, develops a brand awareness, is either satisfied with the product or is not. And those are really your basic building blocks.
Yep.
Whereas in the B2B world, the large corporate enterprise world, it's very much different, right? It's a lot of the purchase considerations happen at a much, much higher level, CIO level, with heavy involvement from IT organizations. And it's a lot more than just pricing. It's your ability to support. Right. It's your lifecycle management. It's the ease of doing business. The sales cycle is much longer. The sales cycle for a B2B contract, large corporate contract, starts the second that you finish signing your previous contract. Right? That's how long your sales cycle is. Yeah. Literally, they will sign a contract for 3 years. And at that point in time, they're all already starting to look, okay, what are we going to do in 3 years, right? And they're planning out that far. So it's a really, really long sales cycle. So when you're in a B2B world, the high-end corporate enterprise world, what happens is that the ease of doing business and your ability to execute smoothly becomes of paramount importance. Because if customers are having issues buying or returning products or, checking order status or getting the reports that they need, that's going to affect your ability to sell next time around, right? And that's why we have the same things such as customer advisory boards, right, where we continuously monitor customer satisfaction and issues and dashboard, all that kind of stuff. A lot of it is efficiency. It's marketing efficiency. Because I think you can, a lot of people can execute marketing programs, right? The question is, how do you measure it? How do you learn from it? And how do you plan your next cycle of marketing based on the learnings that you found, right? So,
okay, so let's talk a little bit about that side of things. Let's start with the measurement side. What things do you think are important to measure, and how do you measure them?
Measurement in an e-commerce world, I think, starts with thinking, what are your objectives? If you're in a business that has high penetration, and you're in a certain stage of your growth cycle, you may not spend as much time worrying about, customer acquisition and those types of things. When I came onto the HP side, we realized that we were, still under-penetrated from an e-commerce perspective as a brand, as in consumer. And so the thing that we were really focused on is getting our message in front of a lot of people and making sure that a lot of people become aware of the store as a shopping destination for HP products. And so what we measure is our efficiency, the core metric from a marketing perspective, is measuring the efficiency of the various marketing vehicles, or just very simply ROI, whether it's up funnel and how it converts later on, or whether it's direct sales. Of course, there are a lot of other metrics that support that. So you have your pre-sales, you have your post-sales. So in the post-sales, in the post-sales cycle, we would measure things such as, ability to deliver on time, or how large our backlogs are. Are we able to fulfill X percentage of customer orders within a certain period of time? Those types of things. Those are all the important post sales cycle metrics.
That's very interesting, because I think a lot of companies neglect that. They figure once they've made the sale, that's what's relevant.
Yes.
But you're quite right. That's really important. How well are we delivering?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I would add to that, a lot of companies are focused on the conversion. But there is a very important concept of micro-conversions, right, which I think it's frequently neglected. A lot of times, you're not going to make a conversion right away. But from my perspective, a lot of those micro-conversions are extremely important, too. So that's the customer sign-up to your newsletter. What is the customer's likelihood to purchase once they've performed a certain type of a micro conversion? So if it's a newsletter sign up, in the future, what is the lifetime value of that customer? Right? So we really have to kind of look at it holistically rather than just that transaction.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been building out our metrics tool sets. Things such as how quickly can we get the metrics in front of our product category managers. They require certain metrics. If they don't have certain data in terms of how things performed, they will not be able to execute against that, right?
Mm-hmm. And do they typically need training to understand how to interpret the metrics?
Typically the challenge, it's funny you should ask that, because the first challenge is lack of metrics. Once you deliver the metrics, the challenge is no time to look at the metrics. So
yeah.
You've got to deliver the metrics in such a way that they're easily actionable on. That's really the challenge.
Right.
Because I'm yet to see like a metrics report that meets everybody's needs and is useful and everything. Like I, in my previous role, we started developing a dashboard from nothing. We ended up with a dashboard that was over 100 pages long monthly.
Wow.
But the question,
that's scary.
Yeah, but the question is, what do you do with the data? I always say that data, that a metric is useless unless it lets you make a change, right? If you see a trend and it's going up or it's going down, if you fail to be able to utilize that to drive change, then it's mm-hmm. pointless. Why are you measuring, right? And I think a lot of times we are asked for certain data, you know, you're in a management meeting and somebody asks, oh, it would be nice to see this. You add it to your dashboard. Oh, it would be nice to see that. And then you end up with massive dashboards. And the question is why, right? Just because somebody at one point asked for something. And so we've done things like, you know, looked at email performance and said, okay, very simply, has an email performed? Have certain links performed? We do A-B testing on very, very trivial things, you know, like do we say free shipping or do we say, you know, we pay for shipping? Like we will do mm-hmm. A-B testing on these types of things because these are key things that customers are looking for. And then we take the data and we say to our marketing teams, to manager, okay, let's make some decisions based on that. But it all starts with mm-hmm. very, very simple metrics. And on top of that, you can overlay some more complex data. But like I said, you have to have time to analyze it. So I think the metrics that are delivered has to be simply actionable. And that's the key. And if you could do that, I mean, you'd be the ultimate company. The problem is that you either don't have metrics or the metrics that you get are not actionable.
Right. So you talked about metrics in terms of things like how well you fulfilled orders.
Mm-hmm.
So there you're really also getting out of the marketing function and into sort of some of the processes internally.
Yeah.
So how do you have influence on what happens there? So let's say you as a marketer realize we're messing up when it comes to actually fulfilling these orders and serving the customers. How do you get that through to the people who are doing that and collaborate with them on what needs changing?
Right. And that's where my role is, I guess, atypical from that perspective, because it's not only a marketing role, right? I view myself as an enabler of growth. I don't view myself as a marketer per se. So what is the thing that's stopping me from growing at that particular moment? So if it is a particular, you know, fulfillment agent fulfilling to a customer and then maybe that customer is returning the product and the product is, you know, going somewhere and the customer doesn't have an idea of what's happening, well, we need to address that because mm-hmm. it's affecting customer experience. That customer is not going to shop in the future. And not only that, they become a negative brand ambassador, right? So you know this thing, right? For every bad customer experience that there is, they affect 10 people. Right?
That right. And now shop. Probably a lot more than 10.
Yeah, and now some people affect a lot more than 10. And my view is that if you're spending all this money on marketing, you have to spend an equal amount of focus on things that are anti-marketing. Because these are things that are anti-marketing, right? You're pulling one way, but your processes are pulling the other way. So where is it more efficient to spend your time? Is it more efficient to spend your time in marketing? Because you may be able to, you know, maybe you have some small operational problems. And if you just devote your time to incremental marketing, those operational problems will be still there, but you get better ROI on marketing, just pure marketing activities. Versus you may be in a situation where, yes, you're investing so much time in marketing, but the customer experience is so bad that really all your work is thrown away.
One of the things that I've seen in a lot of organizations is there's sort of a silo mentality, so it becomes very difficult to cross those boundaries and enable the growth to get through to people, okay, this is what we're seeing here, and this is another area of the organization that needs to change.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had issues like that internally, and how would you recommend dealing with them?
Absolutely. I think every organization has that issue, you know, from the smallest company. So I think the really the best way to resolve that issue is really, I would compare it to a coaching approach, right? So in a coaching approach, what you do is you don't give solutions. You ask people to work with you to come up with their own solutions. So if we sit at a table with stakeholders who are in a certain organization, and rather than coming in a prescriptive way to an organization and saying, this is broken, we need to fix it, I think the best approach is to get a problem in front of people and say, okay, look, so we've got this issue, we need your help. And they become part of defining the issue and be part of the defining the solution. When they do that, they take ownership of that because now it's theirs. They've created it. And if they feel like it's their baby and they're working on it, they're so much more likely to work on it because then they get recognition for it, right? I typically may come up with an idea and say, I need your help. And then people say, no, this is a better way of doing, and then you go maybe that way, and you reach a solution with a consensus. In my experience, it works fabulously.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. In terms of A-B testing, which you say you do a lot of, are there any surprising things that you've come across? What have you learned that surprised you?
Well, I wouldn't say that we do a lot of A-B testing. We probably should do more than we do. But like I said, it's always a question of prioritization, right? I have to quote somebody, and I don't know who said this originally. But I think when it comes to user experience, the one thing that you can safely say is that if you have an assumption about customer behavior and what a person is doing on your site, your assumption is probably wrong. And the things you learn through A-B testing are really unbelievable. So there are certain things that we've tried to A-B test and we said, there's no way this is going to perform. But we're like, okay, well, let's just try it anyway because somebody's claiming that it works, and we try it and lo and behold, it works. And everybody's like, wow, that really shouldn't have worked. And data tells you otherwise. So, you know, the collective intelligence and the collective behavior of thousands of people doing certain tasks and performing in a certain way is much, much smarter than you assuming things.
Right.
So I'm a huge believer in this, and I believe a lot of things should be tested that are totally implausible because you never know what you may find out.
Exactly. One of the things that I'm also curious about, and that seems to be a challenge for a lot of organizations, and we've talked about the website and what consumers are seeing there, and we've talked about the fulfillment aspect. There also is a whole customer service and call center piece, typically, that figures in.
Yes.
How do you incorporate that into what you're doing and what you're measuring?
Yeah, so actually we have pretty robust metrics in terms of both our call center experience as well as our online support experience or chat.
Okay.
And there's actually an interesting correlation that we've seen. And what we have seen is that the more improvements that we make to the customer experience online, the more customers are likely to self-complete the order.
Of course, yeah.
And it's very interesting. And, you know, a lot of times there's a lot to be said about upsell and those types of things, right? That in a call center you can upsell customers. But does that really offset the cost of that call center resource, right? And we have this discussion a lot of times, you know, do we want to drive customers to the call center? But then I think, you know, that affects the customer experience in terms of do they feel like they're being sold to versus they're being from us. We don't really want to sell to the customers. We want to be here. The question of why do we exist as an organization is not really to drive sales. The purpose, because anybody can drive HP sales. It could be channel partner, right? It could be anywhere else. But the reason for existence of the e-commerce store is to give a customer a new avenue to shop in a way that's convenient for them and make it easy.
Okay.
And we always start with that. You know, why are we here? We're here to make it easy for the customer and convenient for the customer, right? Provide value, simplicity.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, what about channel partners? How do you avoid conflicts with them in terms of, you know, if you're selling stuff online that they may also be selling either online or offline? How do you deal with that?
We don't try to compete with the channel on purpose. What we do is we want to be channel neutral. In other words, if a customer wants to buy from a channel, they can. but they can also buy it from HP Direct. And what we try to do is we try to make it easy enough for the customer that they will continue to come to buy to HP because it's the easiest way to purchase. Ideally, what we would want to do is we would want all channels to be super easy to buy from HP. So if you guys just go to Staples, all of a sudden you're having this absolutely amazing HP experience, right? But the thing is, how do you differentiate that, and how do you ensure that a customer buys HP portfolio? When a customer comes to us, they can buy the HP portfolio. So we provide tools like supplies finders, where you can type, you can enter your printer, and it will suggest supplies for you. And the differentiation for us is through driving the customer in a non-competitive way with the channel, but providing the easiest shopping experience, and then upselling the customer on other products that they may be interested in.
So when you say in a non-competitive way, you're saying your prices are not better than theirs, or?
Right. So we may have, like, for example, we may have certain products that we don't ever compete with the channel, right? And I'm not going to say which products it is because that's confidential. But there are certain products where we never, ever compete with the channel. We would never want to be lower than the channel. There are certain products, for example, we take inventory just like anybody else. And at times, if you have too much inventory, we may want to clear that inventory, right? So if you're in an inventory situation where you have too much inventory, that allows you to have a savings story that may be better than a channel. But it's not like that's an ongoing strategy of the store to be lowest price. We have to have a good assortment of products. If we find ourselves with additional inventory, we may want to clear that inventory, and the customer may find that appealing and come back in the future thinking there's going to be a sale. Absolutely. That's something that we can use as a marketing channel.
So do you have any insight about what sort of person goes to buy their products straight on your site versus through something like a Staples where they can compare with other brands?
That depends on what product type you're talking about. So if you're talking about, for example, high-end PCs, a lot of times we have a better breadth of high-end PCs, of HP high-end PCs, than any store does, because obviously we don't have a storefront, right? So, and there's only so many PCs that I can have on display, right? Whereas we, as the manufacturer, we can have the full breadth. So what we find is that in the high-end PC market, we actually have a better breadth, and so a lot of customers come to the HP store.
Okay.
If you're talking about things like supply, it's convenience, right? We do free next-day delivery in Southern Ontario corridor. So if you're sitting at home, you can buy something and you get it the next day, and you don't have to go to the store, right?
Mind you, Staples will give me free next day delivery in Edmonton.
Well, I can't do Edmonton yet. Yeah. Right.
Yes. Are there any final thoughts? I know that at the upcoming ETEL conference, you're going to be talking a lot about the whole metrics side of things, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. Are there any final thoughts on that topic that you'd like to sort of bring up before we wrap up?
If I was to give advice to somebody who's maybe seasoned or somebody who's starting, it's really to pick their battles. And I'm not sure, are you familiar with the concept of Kanban?
Yes.
You are.
But my audience might not be, so maybe you can just briefly explain.
Right. There's this concept of Kanban, which is reducing the number of things that are currently being worked on in order to simplify it. And the idea is that if you think of a production line, if you have, 300 things that are being worked on, or a limited number of things that are being worked on, your final output capacity is probably still going to be limited by a fairly limited number of factors, like amount of workers you have or machinery that you have. So if you eliminate the number of things that you're working on, you eliminate things like task switching, which are productivity killers. And the thing that you have to do is reduce the number of things that you're trying to understand and work on, take the things that are the most important, and get them out the door so you don't have to think about them anymore. And really that.
So how do you decide what's most important?
You always have to have a goal in mind. So I always have a goal in mind of ROI. Like, you just pick a goal that really resonates with you. For me, it's, return on investment. And whether it's money or time, where in my case, usually it's our budget, I look at things and I, at a high level, evaluate opportunities to say, okay, does this sound like a good opportunity? Do I want to evaluate it further? And if it passes my litmus test, you know, it does a certain amount of things, I would go on and I would investigate it further. But I can only investigate so many things at the same time. Otherwise, I end up with 300 things on my plate and nothing's being done.
I know that feeling.
Yeah, a lot of people do, right? So a lot of times I will have discussions with the team members where I say, okay, is this really the most important thing? Is this my priority? And eliminate the number of things that people are working on. And everybody actually agrees with that. When you speak to them, you know, in this type of way, inherently people agree. But then they usually fall back into the default, which is, okay, I gotta work on everything because everything's a priority. And it's not. Eliminate distractions. And I think you'll be very successful.
I think that's a great way to end this interview. That's really excellent advice, not just for e-marketers, but for people in general. We're all so inundated these days that it's a struggle, I think, for pretty much everybody.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for that interview.
That's all for today. Remember to go to frankreactions.com/18, where you can get detailed show notes and also that 25% discount to attend ETAIL Canada in Toronto, May 11th to 14th. There will also be a discount code announced very soon for my listeners if you would rather attend the B2B online conference happening in Chicago at the same time. I really hope I'll get to see you at one or the other of them. If you're coming, give me a shout and let me know. You can reach me just on Twitter with the handle @TemaFrank, T-E-M as in marketing, A-F-R-A-N-K. You can also shoot me an email, tema@frankreactions.com. Leave a phone message or sometimes actually luck out and catch me there at 1-866-544-9262. That's a toll-free number. And whatever method you'd rather use to reach me, I really would love to get your feedback on the show. As some of you may know, that we're relatively new in the Frank Reactions podcast. I used to host the Frank Online Marketing Show. And I'm really curious to know if this is working for you. What would you like more of? What would you like less of? Please give me a shout and let me know. That's all for now. Chat with you again next week. Bye.